Amelia IOX is supported by the Slider Agency on Main Street in Margaretville, a neighborhood independent insurance agency educating consumers about the availability of flood insurance, even for those living in a flood hazard zone, and about coverage options. Open Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 5. More information at 845-586-2641. Or SliderAgency.com.
Hello, hello. Nicole Bomer here, host of Blues Show Something Old, Something Blue, every Wednesday night from 8 to 10, and classic rock show Smokin' Saturdays that happens alternate Saturday nights, also from 8 to 10. And you are listening to WIOX Roxbury, live and local in New York's Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20, and WIOXRadio.org.
You're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local, in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and everywhere at WIOXRadio.org, where it's easy to donate if you like what you hear. You can also get WIOX on any smart device through the FM radio apps. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Going good, Ryan. How are you?
I'm okay.
Still pruning those apple trees?
Every day.
That's right. Yeah, we did a whole bunch today.
Yeah, every day. What have you been up to?
I haven't been out for walks in the woods in the last week. It's been just a busy week working on my house.
Oh, yeah?
Painting now.
Painting, huh?
Yeah, bathroom and working on the kitchen and living room next. So maybe this weekend I'll get out for a walk and let you know what I've been seeing. But driving around, saw some bucks that were still had their antlers. So that was kind of unique for this time of year. They're losing their antlers, but usually by January they've lost them. So early February, mid-February is kind of getting late. So that was something I noticed.
No kidding. Yeah, I haven't seen too much. Just been busy doing some maple sugaring on the side. Just a little backyard sugaring like I do every year. And I don't know. It seems to me that although it's wet right now, it's been raining and stuff, the ground is not as wet. I'm not getting the sap that I usually get.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, my ground is very saturated in my yard, but that's only been since this last storm. Before then, it was kind of dry, but I don't know. Maybe there's something to that. Then you got to have sap and water in the ground for the trees to flow. So it's definitely a theory. But you say your season you think is almost over.
You know, it's weird. usually at the end of the season, the sap will be less and it'll start turning yellow. And I got buckets turning yellow and giving me less sap, behaving like it's beginning of March or mid-March. And so, you know.
Wow.
Mine usually peter out before other people's because, one, I tap earlier, so that does do something. But also it's southeast facing, and they're just warmer than everyone else's.
They get
full sunlight, and, you know.
Yeah, I don't have anything to compare this year because I haven't tapped. I probably won't, so.
Yeah, the sugar content is, I would say, at least a half percent less. A half to a quarter percent less than it usually is. So, you know, I don't know. We'll see. But I'm just happy what I got. It's good tasting syrup, and I can't complain. But tonight's topic is actually ancient fossil forests, ancient fossil forests of the Catskills with Dr. Chris Berry. Let me see if I can get him on. Hey, Chris, you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right. How are you doing tonight?
I'm good, thank you. Quite late in the evening, but I'm doing right. I'm over here in Wales, UK.
So you're in the United Kingdom. It's 11 p.m., you said?
That's right.
Man, well, thanks for taking the time and talking to us over here in New York State.
That's no problem. It's one of my favorite places to be, so I hope I get back there soon.
So just to introduce you, I'm talking to Dr. Chris Berry of, I don't know if I'll say this right, Cardiff University in the United Kingdom. Is that right?
Yes, it's in Wales, yes.
Okay, Wales. And Chris is a paleobotanist specializing in understanding of early radiation of large plants and the birth of forest ecosystems in Devonian period. That's 300 million years ago, John.
Whoa.
All right? You know, we're not talking like...
Wasn't yesterday.
his expertise is based upon field work in Svalbard, Greenland, China, USA, Venezuela, Colombia, Argentina. So you get around.
Yes, it's one of the great things about being a paleontologist is that you have to go to the places where the rocks are of the age that you're interested in. And so I get to work in some pretty exotic places.
And that's Svalbard. I don't know how to say that. Is that in Greenland or is that a separate place?
Svalbard's actually off the north. If you go up the north of Norway and then you fly north for another couple of hours towards the North Pole, it's about 80 degrees north up there.
No kidding. Okay.
Wow. What is the weather like year-round, I guess, in that area?
It's pretty cold just about now, but the sun will be rising for a while every day, and... by the middle of the summer, it's maybe about 10 degrees centigrade for most of the time, obviously with 24-hour daylight, so you can just work and work and work.
Wow.
So what got you into paleobotany, and I guess how would you define paleobotany?
Well, paleobotany is the study of ancient plant life based around fossils, and... it's a subject which, the further you go back in the past, the more and more strange the plants get. They get less and less like the ones that you see around you. And how I got into it, well, it's more or less a mistake, really. I went to university to study physics, and I had to study four subjects. So I'd have math, physics, and chemistry. And I also took geology because I'd done some geology at school, and I thought that'd be an easy thing to do. And I very quickly realized that I hated doing physics, and I really couldn't do the sort of math they wanted me to do. And at the same time, I had some very inspirational lecturers in geology and particularly in paleontology. And after a few months, I realized that, you know, you could be a paleontologist and you could study at university. And I hadn't really worked that out before I actually got there. So I was lucky that I was at a university where you could more or less change direction. And I did that and became a paleontologist.
No kidding. And at Cardiff University, where you are now, you're in the School of Earth and Ocean Sciences?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And so paleobotany. I was reading an article, and it had to do with our Catskill Mountains, and that's how I found out about you. In fact, I think one of our members forwarded it to me. And it was okay. News to me. I've heard about the Gilboa Forest, but I've never actually visited the site, even though we've driven by it, John. How many times? I mean, Jesus, this guy's coming from England or UK, and we can't even get out of our cars to go look at the ferns.
I know. We should do that next time.
Do that next time, yeah.
You really should. There's a great museum in Gilboa Village down near the dam, and there's wonderful people running it, and it really is worth dropping by. And there's some good local history there as well, not just about fossil trees. So, yeah, do go.
And you also, when I sent you this outline before the show, I didn't know that there's another fossil forest in Caro, also in Greene County.
Yes, that's down, I guess, down Route 23 from you, out into just into the Hudson Valley. Yes, I mean, this is a newly reported discovery that the paper came out around Christmas time, and that's probably how it's come onto your radar now.
Okay, I see. All right, so for people like myself and others who don't know anything about, you know, paleobotany, what is a fossil forest?
Well, a fossil forest is the record of an ancient forest. So many of the fossils that we deal with are just plant fossils, an individual plant that's been squashed and turned to coal. A fossil forest is where you can see where the trees were actually growing one next to each other. And so it gives you an insight into the ecology of the ancient world and not just the biology of one individual plant. So ideally, like at Gilboa, you might see actual tree trunk bases standing in the ground if you're really lucky. Whereas at Caro, you just see the remains of the roots and you can't see the actual trees, but you can tell where the trees were growing one next to another. And for them to exist, then the trees must have been buried by sediment, usually in quite a catastrophic sort of way. So you might have a storm washing sand in off a beach across a barrier island into a forest, or maybe a river flooding and bringing lots and lots of sediment and dumping it on top of the ground and flooding and drowning the trees out. Much like I think if you see a beaver dam and you see the trees sort of dead in the water, and that can happen as well.
How did you think that the Gilboa forest was preserved then?
Well, the Gilboa forest is interesting because the trees at Gilboa, which are up to a meter in diameter, so they're really large chunks of rock, the trees there are about a meter tall, and then they suddenly stop. They're truncated at about a meter. And what we understand from everything we can see is that a huge amount of sand, which is very clean sand, so it looks like it's come off a beach or a coastline, has just been dumped around the trees, and the trees have been standing there, and it's probably killed them. And the trees at Gilboa are a very special type of tree, which we might talk about later, which were more or less hollow. So when they died, it was then very easy for the inside of the tree to fill up with sediment. And then this is buried and buried and buried for hundreds and then thousands and then millions of years. And the weight of all the rock on top of that just squashes it down until it itself turns into a fossil of a tree stump, and then that can be discovered all these years later.
How fine can you see from these fossils, I guess?
Well, it really depends on what the way that they've been preserved. So if a tree has essentially decayed away and then been the hole where it was filled up with sand, there's not much of the original tree left apart from its shape. So that's a bit disappointing, really, at Gilboa, because you have these wonderful trees and you can't tell terribly much about how they grew and how they worked as trees. Unfortunately, there's different types of preservation around the world, so other trees may have fallen over sideways and been squashed and turned to coal, and then we can see their outline and study their morphology, their shape. But then you sometimes get extraordinary fossils. And for example, in China, in Xinjiang province in northwest China, you get trees which are almost exactly the same as the Gilboa trees, but instead of just being turned to sandstone, they've actually been standing in an environment where I think they've been buried in some volcanic ash. And volcanic ash dissolves very readily and turns into silica, a bit like in Yellowstone Park, where you get silica-rich water. And that's infiltrated into the tree and preserved every single cell in the tree. And then you can make thin sections of the tree which look as if you've made a thin section of a living plant. They're so well preserved that absolutely every cell is visible. So if we need to look inside the Gilboa trees, then it's best to go to fossils from somewhere else in the world, like China.
How rare are these fossil forests?
Oh, so fossil forests can be very rare at certain times in the geological past. So I think everybody knows that in the Carboniferous, in the big coal fields down in Pennsylvania and Virginia, then the coal seams there are essentially fossil forests with the trees lying down and sometimes standing up. And in the Carboniferous period, which follows the Devonian period that we're talking about, then they're relatively common. And, of course, there's wonderful fossil forests in Arizona and of much younger age and so on. But in the Devonian, which is the period when large trees first appeared on the Earth, then they're extremely rare. So at this very time when forests were emerging, there's just three known. And there's the two in New York State at Cairo and Gilboa. And then there's one in Svalbard, in this Arctic place north of Norway. And just very recently, one from the very, very end of the Devonian period has been discovered in eastern part of China. So in the whole of the Devonian period, when the forests appeared, then there's only four known in the world.
Okay, so it's really rare.
It is really rare. And to be honest, I mean, the Gilboa forest was really first described in detail by the team that I work with. It was published in 2012. The Cairo forest was published just this Christmas time. And the one in Svalbard was published in 2015. And the one in China was published, I think, last year as well, in 2019. So you can see that it's only in the last 10 years that we've really had any understanding of what the very first forests might have looked like. So this is completely new. You won't find it in textbooks and things like that.
I mean, I guess one thing that comes to my mind is why maybe we found it in the Catskills is of the extreme amount of land manipulation going on with the, you know, the watershed project. What's going on in China? How did they find it?
In China, there are a lot of paleontologists working, many more than I think than you might find in America or in Europe. And they still survey, they go out and survey large parts of the landscape. So some of the things that are found in China just are literally poking out of the ground in some place. The fossil forest right at the end of the Devonian in China was found in a rock quarry, much like Cairo or, in fact, Gilboa when you look into the distant past. So, it does help to have these big exposures where you can see the bottom of a quarry. I think that trees, by the action of their roots, form soils, and soils contain a lot of clay. And if you are extracting stone for use in road bases or something like that. You get to the layer with lots of clay in it. It becomes much softer than the sandstone that you're trying to extract. And so the quarrymen will finish their quarrying at that level. And if you're lucky, they don't come back and go down another level, and then they leave you the fossil forest on the bottom of their quarry. So I think there's a more than an element of luck there. I think there's a reason for the quarrymen stopping at the level where you get the fossil trees.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. with Ryan and John. Tonight's topic is Ancient Fossil Forests of the Catskills with Dr. Chris Berry. He's calling from the United Kingdom, and we're talking about this ancient fossil forest that has been found in both Caro, Greene County, and also Gilboa and Schoharie County. So we can talk about the Caro site since it's more recent rather than the Gilboa site if you'd like.
We could talk about both. It's up to you.
Okay.
I think one of the interesting things is actually comparing them and seeing how they're different.
Yeah, sure.
So,
And the Gilboa site was first discovered in 1920, right? After a flood, I was reading.
It's more complicated than that. Back in the 1850s, there was a local clergyman called Mr. Lockwood, and he found some fossil plants in the Schoharie Creek, and he got very excited about them, but he kept them to himself, and then they were described in about 1871 by a Canadian paleontologist called J.W. Dawson. Those fossils, actually, one of the things I managed to do with the help of my friend Linda at the New York State Museum is we actually tracked those very first original Catskill fossil plants to the collections at Yale University, which wasn't easy to do, but they still exist today in the collections at Yale. Then in 1869, there was a huge storm, one of these horrible storms that I know that you had Hurricane Irene, which caused all sorts of problems. It must have been something like that that occurred and washed away a lot of things in the valley. And my understanding is that in order to repair the damage, they had to get stone, and they blasted stone from the sides of the river valley. And at that point, they found some standing tree stumps, and they were the first to be found. And Dawson also got excited about those fossils and published some information about it. But then it was in 1920 when the Gilboa Dam was constructed, a large quarry was opened up just the other side of the main road from where the Gilboa Museum is today. And that quarry is called Riverside Quarry, and a huge amount of stone was extracted from that to face the dam itself. And it was all the stone was cut out and then transported up to the dam on, I think, a little railways. And in the process of doing that, they started coming across these enormous tree stumps standing in the rock. And the New York State Museum was alerted, and a paleontologist, the state paleontologist, was Winifred Goldring. And she went up there to see these fossils, and she started to study them and describe them. And at the same time, the quarry owners were very excited about them, and they collected a lot themselves and, in fact, sent them to museums all over the world. So you can go into the museum in Stockholm or various other places, and especially around the States as well. And you'll find these trees. And in fact, a couple of years ago, I found a letter saying that one had been sent to London, the Natural History Museum. So I wrote to my friend, the curator, down in London and said, can I see your fossil tree? Because, you know, it's easier to come and see your fossil tree than go to the States and see them. And they said, well, we have no idea about that. How do you know? And so I sent them a copy of the letter, and they've actually found this fossil tree, and it's a really nice one. at the back of a disused bus depot in a suburb of London. And so they dug it out. And at that time, they're refurbishing the main hall of the Natural History Museum in London, where the big dinosaur skeleton used to be. And now that Gilboa tree is right in the front of a cabinet in the main hall of the Natural History Museum, and 4 million people walk past it every year. So these are really famous fossils.
Oh, I think we just maybe have lost them, huh? You still there? All right, we're going to take a break. If you're just tuning in and you're listening to From the Forest, every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., and we'll see if we can get Dr. Barry back on the phone. He's talking about ancient fossil forests of the Catskills.
Sit here lonely like a broken man. Sell my time and doing the best I can. Walls and bars that surround in me, but I don't want your sympathy yet. Oh baby, I just need your tender loving to keep me sane in this burning oven. When my time is up, be my reaper, like I was worked on God's cleaner. Back to work again. Pains and blisters on my mind and my hands. From living daily with those canvas bags. Thoughts of freedom, they're driving me wild. And I'll be happy like a newborn child. Be together, girl, you wait and see. No more walls, keep your love from me. Yeah! Can't you feel?
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. Tonight's topic is ancient fossil forests of the Catskills with Dr. Chris Berry. He's calling from the United Kingdom, which reminds me, We have a member. He's an underwater diver hooking up those cables across the ocean floor. You imagine?
Maybe that's when someone needs to call him up to figure out why these calls are dropping.
Well, I guess Dr. Chris Berry is now on his mobile since the landline cut out, so we're going to have to get our other member to get in the water and fix it. How's it going? You still there? Maybe not. Let's see. Oh, he's there now. I think I got him. How you doing?
I'm here.
It helps to press the button. It was my fault that time.
Good.
Yeah. So I think we got you back. And so if you find a spot, you know, like an ancient fossil forest, when you found one in Caro or Gilboa, how do you go about, you know, researching this site? Like, what's your first steps to, I don't even know. How do you do it?
So I've been working on these sites with colleagues from Binghamton University. That's Bill Stein in Binghamton, and Linda Van Allen-Hernick and Frank Manolini at the New York State Museum. And one of the big deals is to actually clean off the surface that you've got, because you need to be able to see all the fossils there. And that is a thing that you can do, first of all, in the Gilboa Quarry. We did it with pressure hoses, and the construction company did that. And then in Caro, we just did it by brushing it off with big brushes.
Wow.
So, that's the first thing you do. And then you try to make a map of the bottom of the quarry. And this is work largely done by Bill and Frank with some help from Linda. And they literally take a photograph of every square, draw out a grid, and then take a photograph of every square, and then draw onto a piece of paper exactly what's in the bottom of the forest to try and map which trees stand next to which other trees. And that's really the first step of trying to construct some sort of record of what's there. Of course, this was 10 years ago, and now we would just probably put in a grid, but we'd go up with a drone and then take photographs from a drone.
I wonder if you can one day use like LIDAR technology or thermal imaging or something like that.
Yes, absolutely right. We were just we didn't have much time in the Gilboa Quarry, and it was early days for that sort of technology. But if that happened again, because the Gilboa Quarry is quite three dimensional, the surface undulates around the base of the trees, and a LIDAR survey coupled with photographs as well would have produced a beautiful three-dimensional image of the bottom of that quarry. And we'd certainly do that now if we had the opportunity with a similar site.
Okay, so what did you find there? I mean, are these trees? Are they ferns? Are they tree ferns? What are these huge plants you found at Gilboa and Caro?
Okay, so the Gilboa trees are a special type of trees called cladozolopsids. And they look a bit like tree ferns or even palm trees, apart from the leaves or the fronds are not flat and green. They're like little spiky, twiggy things rather than big, flat leaves. And tapering from quite a big base, the trunk would taper upwards until it was about 15 centimeters in diameter, and go up about maybe 10, 12 meters in height, and have quite a big fat top, like a very much like a palm tree rather than like a conifer. And the main thing to know about these trees is, as I said before, they're sort of hollow, and all the wood around the outside is actually in a series of strands, maybe about 200 strands, about the size and thickness of a large pencil, all joined together in a sort of network and mesh, which formed a very structurally strong but probably quite flexible trunk. So it's a bit like the structure of the Eiffel Tower or something. It's more like a network with a hole up the middle rather than being a big solid trunk of wood. What was really interesting at Gilboa was that there was also a second type of tree which did have a woody trunk, but it lay along the ground and sort of snaked between the cladozoolopsid trees. And that had little twiggy branches coming out of the top of this running ground tree. So it's quite
they're not
strange.
Like, so they're not ring porous, right? I mean, you don't see rings in them. They're more like, I mean, palm trees are, aren't they really monocots or whatever? I don't know what the term is, but I forget.
Well, they're not related to it. We don't know how the standing up trees are related, but the ones lying along the ground have genuine, solid, woody trunks, almost certainly. And they're more related to the early forms of conifers.
Okay.
So they were like conifers, apart from the fact they didn't really have leaves and they didn't have seeds. But the wood is very similar to conifer wood on a sort of approximate basis. And it's funny that these ones lay down on the ground. Because if you go to Cairo, you have a very similar type of plant, very closely related, but the trunk stood upright, and it did have leafy branches, and it did have huge rooting systems, just like a modern conifer, but it still didn't have seeds. So it was a bizarre sort of intermediate between a tree with a fern-like tree and a conifer tree. And I think the big surprise at Cairo was the size of the rooting systems. I mean, they're absolutely massive. The roots go out for 11 or 12 yards from the center of the tree.
Now, what kind of climate does these ancient trees grow in? I mean, we're in the Catskills right now. It's pretty mild for this winter, but, you know, Friday is going to be -9 or whatever, 0.
Yeah, we haven't had a winter at all yet. It's just rained here in Cardiff. So you have to wind back in history a lot, and I'm sure you know that the continents moved around over the years. So back in those days, you were probably about 20 degrees south of the equator. And the climate would have been quite warm, but periodically a bit cooler and wetter. So there was some sort of seasonality to it. But when we look at the soils that the trees at Cairo were growing in, it has nodules of calcium carbonate in it a little bit, but more... Obviously, there are clay minerals which have swelled and shrunk as they do during periods when you wet them and then dry them. You know that the soil will move during that type of activity. So we think that there were periods of the year that were drying really quite warm and the other periods of the year when it was a little bit wetter. You can... look at tree rings to detect climate in a modern-day setting. Now, I've told you that most of the fossils that we have from Gilboa and mostly from Cairo as well, they tend to be without any sort of internal structure so that you can't look at tree rings as such. But we're very lucky that at Glenin Gilboa, where there's another dam and a lake there, when they constructed the power units that I think are on the other side of the lake from Lancing, the manor there, then they found some fossils that did have structure in them, preserved in pyrite. Their fossils belong to the woody lying down trees, similar to the ones at Gilboa, and they do have evidence of some growth rings in them. And that also implies the fact that there was some seasonality, that there's a time of the year when the growth of the plant slowed down, and then another time of the year when the growth of the plant speeded up. So we can read these ancient fossil trees to a certain extent in terms of their climate signals.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is Ancient Fossil Forest of the Catskills with Dr. Chris Berry. And we're talking about the two ancient fossil forests in Caro, Greene County, and Gilboa, Schoharie County of the Catskill Mountains. What do you think is the purpose of finding ancient forest? I was researching some of the stuff you were saying in some of the articles, and you're trying to understand how transition to a forested planet impacts the environment. What have you found in that respect?
Well, that's right. I mean, we know that today we try not to burn down forests and destroy the Amazon forest and so on. We realize the importance of forests. So what we're looking at is the difference between a planet with no forest in the early parts of the Devonian before 400 million years ago, and then what was the impact of having forests develop across the lowlands of this developing Earth, and what would it affect, and if there's any take-home messages, I guess, for today. And as you can imagine, one of the things that would have happened, that when you've grown lots of woody trees for the first time, is that you would begin to take lots of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and build it into the tree structures. And if you then buried them in sediment, then of course that carbon dioxide, the carbon would be removed from the atmosphere for a long, long time. It's only if you were to burn the coal from the trees that it would go back up into the atmosphere. So this is one of the areas of inquiry. And from various lines of evidence, it's believed that during the Devonian, in fact, there was a massive transformation of the atmosphere. That perhaps at the beginning of the Devonian, there were maybe 15 times as much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as today. And then by the end of it, there would be almost the same amount of carbon dioxide that was in the present-day atmosphere. So this is a dramatic transformation. I should also mention there's a second way in which plants remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and that's their roots. I was listening to one of your podcasts with a chap talking about tree roots, some really interesting stuff. Plant roots secrete acids, and they have associations with fungi in the roots, which attack minerals and break them down. And one of the consequences of that breakdown of minerals to form clay is that, again, carbon is taken out of the atmosphere and turned into bicarbonate acids, which they're soluble, they're in water. So that atmospheric carbon goes into groundwater and then goes down into rivers and eventually into the sea. And there it can react with other ions and form limestone, which is calcium carbonate. So that's another way in which plants can take carbon out of the atmosphere and lock it up into the rock record and just remove it. And so these two processes combined probably had a really dramatic effect on the atmosphere at that time.
How long did this time period last?
Oh, so from the beginning of trees through till the end of the Devonian, we're looking at a period of approximately 35 million years. And you can go back another 30 million years before that, when you have small plants developed on the land surface, which will be doing some of this at the same time. So, yeah, it's a long period of time, but for geologists, it's not such a big deal, really.
Are you seeing any trends in maybe why these forests disintegrated or evolved to something else?
Well, I think probably, certainly the woody trees that we see, they set the new standard for what forests would be like, and probably evolved into some of the later forms of forest. So although they themselves disappeared, they probably had close relatives who went on to play major parts in subsequent ecosystems. And the cladozoopsid trees, the Gilboa tree, the famous one, this is the thing that looks like a tree fern, but it doesn't have leaves. It has little sticky organs instead of leaves. That's a difficult one because it was a very successful plant, and it presumably photosynthesized very easily. But it may be that the high level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is necessary for photosynthesis, was okay without leaves. These little sticks were able to absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere when the levels were very high. But as the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere dropped down and down and down, and they didn't have leaves to photosynthesize efficiently, they may have effectively sealed their own death warrant by removing the carbon dioxide they needed from the atmosphere, and then were unable to effectively compete with all the other nice green leaved plants that were around. So they may have just become obsolete as biological organisms because of the changing environment.
Very interesting.
That makes sense. Yeah, I could see that. I guess. I mean, and then also it goes going towards trees, you know, that produce seeds, right? I mean, because these, we don't know if these produce seeds, right? Or we do know that they didn't.
Well,
I'm not sure.
Well, we do know that they didn't because we can get hold of their reproductive organs, which are called sporangia, because they hold spores. They're just little structures, a couple of millimeters long, and they often hold hundreds or thousands of individual spores in them. Spores and pollen are made out of a substance which is called sporopollenin, which is incredibly resistant to decay. And so we're lucky that if they're buried in an environment which isn't very oxygen-rich, these reproductive bits, although they're only, you know, fractions of a millimeter in size, they can be preserved for 400 million years with almost no decay at all.
Get out of town, really?
Yeah, no, really. It's amazing stuff called sporopollenin. I had a colleague who's trying to learn how to make it. We can't even break it down to find out what's in it, but he was trying to make it because, of course, if you can make this stuff, then you paint your house with it, and you don't have to paint your house for another 400 million years.
Wow.
So it'd be really good stuff. But nobody can make it. So, yeah. So we have to keep on painting our house every couple of years now. But anyway, so we can get those out, and we really know that they're not seeds. About the same time, there's some interesting plants doing interesting things and just making, instead of making thousands of tiny little spores, they're making just one big sort of female spore and lots of little male spores. And so they're beginning to tend towards being a seed, which is effectively just one big spore inside a sort of coating. But they haven't achieved it yet, and it's definitely not these groups which are forming the big forest trees that were doing that. So, yeah, I'm very confident that there were no trees with seeds at this time.
And you didn't find any fauna, like, you know, animals or anything?
Okay, so this is something we're really interested in. And no, we haven't found many things. What we tend to find is occasionally little segments of millipedes. You know, if you imagine a millipede and then just pulled one segment off it, sometimes you find those. Sometimes when you break down the rocks with nasty acids to try and get the spore out, in the way that I was just talking about, then you find occasionally legs and bits of other things. And a really good place to do that is, in fact, Blenheim Gilboa. At Blenheim Gilboa, you have some of the best preserved early insects that have ever been found. And they're just small things like mites and early forms of spiders and particularly millipedes that are wandering around. The millipedes eat decaying plant matter. So they were wandering around in the bottom of these forests, eating the bits of the trees that were falling down as the trees grew upwards.
So were they relatively the same as a modern millipede now? I mean, so have they gone unchanged for 400 million years?
It's hard to be sure, but in terms of their shape, yeah. I mean, they're pretty much related to modern millipedes. So they were just, some of them were quite big, you know, not massively big, but, you know, fairly chunky, a centimeter or so in width, maybe a little bit more. And some of the early spider-like animals were carnivorous, so they were probably eating other insect-like animals. What we have not found good evidence of is anything with a backbone. You know, there's no amphibians or anything on the land, as far as we know. There's no vertebrate animals. So the land must have been quite quiet. Unless these insects were making a noise, then it must have been a very quiet place where you could only hear the wind in the trees, really.
Yeah, who knows? What do you think, John?
I'm interested.
What do you think most surprised you that you've found so far?
In the Catskills, I think the most surprising thing that certainly my colleagues have found were these massive roots at Cairo, found by Chuck Verstappen at the New York State Museum. I mean, just enormous, these enormous rooting systems. I really, really, really didn't expect to see those so far back in time. In fact, when I first sent a photograph of that site, they were standing there with these sort of traces of these big roots across the bottom of the quarry. And in the background, the highway department, the Cairo Highway Department, had dumped some bases of trees just on the ground, a big pile of them. Imagine the, you know, bases of fairly substantial trees with the roots sticking in all directions. And my instinct was that what had happened was there had been a tree growing on the bottom of the forest, and somebody had come along and ripped it up, and it sort of left a groove across the bottom of the forest. So I just couldn't believe with my eyes that there was anything forming big, huge, woody roots so long ago. But investigations and so on proved me completely wrong. I mean, there really are 385 million-year-old huge trees.
So where are you off to next, Chris?
Oh, I'm not sure. I'm involved in projects in China, and that's obviously a little bit tricky at the moment, so we're just waiting to see what happens over there. What I'd like to do in terms of ambition is, I think with my colleagues particularly in New York State, I think, if anything, over the last 20 years, what we've really done is moved the origin of forests, which if you look in textbooks, is all in the end of the Devonian. We've moved them down sort of 10, 15, even 20 million years older than people thought, and come up with these amazing types of trees, which people have only, you know, we've only understood them for a few years, what they look like, how they grew, all that sort of thing. And so, really, we now need to find the precursors of these early forests. There must be plants which were, you know, gradually getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And we have in Belgium and Germany, we have trees, which are about 7 or 8 million years older than Karoo or Gilboa, but not forests. We just have the individual plant fossils, which are little trees 2 or 3 or 4 meters tall. And there must be even smaller trees before. So really, my focus, if anything, would be now to finish up describing the things that we found in the States, particularly in Karoo and in South Mountain, in the South Mountain Forest Reserve there. We found fantastic fossils, which we haven't yet.
Well, Chris, we're running out of time, but also you're breaking up at, right at the end for some reason. But, yeah, that last part isn't coming out clearly. But we're out of time anyway, and it flew by. And thank you so much for coming. Oh, I can hear you again now. I guess I can hear you now. Yeah, for some reason it was coming in garbled. But thank you for taking the time. I mean, it's all new to us, and it's hard to even picture 380 million years ago, huh, John?
It's very interesting.
Yeah, do get down to the Gilboa Museum. I really promise you, you have a great time if you get there.
All right. Well, once again, thank you for coming on, and have a good night. And, thanks for talking to us at almost midnight in England.
Thank you. In Wales.
Wales, I'm sorry. Wales. It's Wales, not England, John.
Yes.
Come on. All right. Take care.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Have a good night.
Good night.
Wales. I don't know anything about Wales. Do you, John?
No, don't ask me.
I have to look at my geography a little bit. Is Wales like in the northern part of the United Kingdom or something? Come on.
I think the person who's on the next show might be able to fill us in a little bit. Rick, who's doing mostly British music next.
Mostly British, but not mostly Wales.
Well, he might be in tune a little bit.
Isn't Led Zeppelin from Wales? Anyway. Up next is Mostly British with Rick Neblong, and that's all I got on From the Forest. Have a good night.
Good night, everyone.
Oh, the neon lights were flashing and the icy wind did blow. The water seeped into his shoes and the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year. When the wildflowers did bloom in the forest, she touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest.
WIOX is supported by Pico Moose Restaurant on Route 28 in Big Indian, featuring farmhouse cuisine prepared with locally grown ingredients and a growing wine and craft beer list. Open for dinner Thursday through Monday at 4 p.m. The Pico Moose Tap Room and Lounge serves